At this time, CBS World News will attempt to bring you a scheduled address to the people of France by General Charles de Gaulle, leader of the French Committee of National Liberation. General de Gaulle will speak from London, and if we are able to pick up his talk, you will hear a running translation of his address by Beverly Thurman of Columbia's shortwave news staff. This is CBS in New York, and in a few moments, we will switch you to London for the scheduled address of General Charles de Gaulle. But in the meantime, while we're waiting for the general to begin, we might mention that it was announced only this morning that he had arrived in Britain. As you know, his trip to England has been planned for some time, and he is scheduled to discuss at length with Prime Minister Churchill and other leaders the problems of his committee. High on the list of subjects to be discussed, it is commonly believed, is the question of whether General de Gaulle's Committee of Liberation is to be granted full or provisional recognition as the present government of France. At the present time, the Committee of Liberation does not enjoy the recognition already granted to exile governments of other occupied nations, which now have their headquarters in London. The news bulletin this morning announcing de Gaulle's arrival in London also mentioned that he has already had a first meeting with Mr. Churchill, shortly after the first news came of the invasion of his country by Allied troops. De Gaulle had apparently arrived some time before, but news of his presence in London had been held back for reasons of military security. We are still waiting for General de Gaulle to begin speaking in London. In the meanwhile, we'll bring you invasion news up to this moment. With that other climactic occasion, December 7th, 1941, was marked. News of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor was disseminated from the White House with, as one reporter recalled, a flash a minute. This time, the White House seemed to be sleeping through the first phases of the action. Here's a late bulletin from London which says that more than 1,000 American heavy bombers attacked enemy targets in France this morning in support of the invasion. Military observers in London said today that a general Russian offensive coordinated with the Anglo-American attack from the West may be launched within the next 48 hours, and almost certainly will begin before the weekend. News of the Allied landing in France spread swiftly throughout Russia today and touched off enthusiastic demonstrations such as rarely have been seen since the war began. American war correspondents in Moscow were the first to break the news, and they were quickly surrounded by cheering crowds who rushed to shake their hands and to offer congratulations. Radio Moscow's chief announcer, who customarily reads only Premier Stalin's orders of the day, broadcasted General Dwight D. Eisenhower's special communique announcing the landing. He read the bulletin in a solemn and triumphant tone, rivaling his best performance for the Red Army's biggest victory announcements. Soviet war marches, Yankee Doodle, and the triumphal music reserved for Stalin's victory orders followed the bulletin. For 2 weeks now, the Russian people have been expecting the invasion to begin at any moment. And the question on everyone's lips was, has it started? The Soviet people now are waiting for their own armies to strike from the east in the coordinated offensive mapped out at the Tehran Conference. The German's Transocean News Agency said today that a battle was in progress in the English Channel north of Le Havre between German naval units and Allied forces attempting to make a landing. Nazi broadcasters said the Allies had won footholds on several islands off the coast of France. Earlier, they reported landings in the Channel Islands west of the Norman Peninsula. That's the Normandy Peninsula. The Transocean Agency reported that a naval battle was going on in the channel north of Le Havre between German units and Allied forces trying to make a landing. DNB, the official Nazi agency, said German counterthrusts were being undertaken east of Cherbourg, but the enemy keeps throwing the bulk of his troops into the area between Cherbourg and Ustraham. The 28th and 101st American Parachute Divisions dropped in the Normandy area, DNB reported, adding the usual propaganda claim that many of these soldiers were captured. Ladies and gentlemen, this is CBS World News in New York. We had expected to bring you an address by General Charles de Gaulle speaking in London, but so far we've been unable to contact that point. Meanwhile, we're bringing you news of the invasion to bring you up to date on what has occurred in this biggest of all days, the invasion of Western Europe. An American war correspondent, Stanley Richardson, who has just returned from the Second Front beachhead with the first naval eyewitness of the operations. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we're informed that we can hear from General de Gaulle in London. So we switch you now to London for the address by General de Gaulle.
Que nous gagnerons celle-là. en bon ordre.
Pour nos armées de terre, de mer, de l'air,
il n'y a point là de problème.
Jamais elles ne furent plus ardentes, plus habiles, plus disciplinées.
L'Afrique,
l'Italie,
l'océan et le ciel ont vu
leur force et leur gloire renaissante.
La terre natale les verra demain
pour la nation qui se bat.
General de Gaulle says that never have France's forces of the air, sea, and land had such a glorious opportunity to distinguish themselves. And he speaks of the glories which the French armies have just achieved in the Italian campaign.
Par le gouvernement français et par les chefs français, il a qualifié pour le faire à l'échelon national et à l'échelon local soit exactement suivi. La seconde est que l'action menée par nous sur les arrières de l'ennemi soit conjuguée aussi étroitement que possible avec celle que mène de front les armées alliées.
General de Gaulle says that the first order which the French government has to give to the French forces will be followed exactly.
Que l'action des forces de la résistance doit durer pour aller s'amplifiant jusqu'au moment de la déroute allemande. La troisième condition est que tous ceux qui sont capables d'agir, soit par les armes, soit par les destructions, soit par le renseignement.
General de Gaulle says that the action which the French armies will carry out with the Allies against the enemy will be exactly conjugated with those of the Allies.
Ou à la déportation, quelles que soient les difficultés, tout vaut mieux.
And with these actions, that of French resistance will also be combined.
La bataille de France a commencé.
Il n'y a plus dans la nation, dans l'Empire, dans les armées, qu'une seule et même volonté, qu'une seule et même espérance, derrière le nuage.
And General de Gaulle says that it is absolutely necessary that all French patriots capable to act by arms and by refusing to work for the Germans should not allow themselves to be taken prisoner.
Le peuple français qui vous est parvenu de Londres. Nous vous retournons au studio de la Voix de l'Amérique à New York.
And General de Gaulle said in concluding that the Battle of France has begun and there is no longer except a single sole will to conquer on the part of the French nation.
You have just heard a speech by General Charles de Gaulle and its translation, a running translation of that speech by Beverly Thurman of Columbia's shortwave news staff. General de Gaulle spoke to you from London. And now here in CBS World News headquarters in New York is Columbia's distinguished commentator, Mr. Quincy Howe.
The news of Allied landings on the north coast of France has given the war its most dramatic and sudden change since the Germans invaded Russia. Up to less than 12 hours ago, the Russians and the Russians alone had engaged and defeated millions of German troops in vast land battles. Our North African and Italian campaigns had diverted some German strength from Russia, so had our preparations for invasion from the west. The fall of Mussolini in July and the fall of Rome day before yesterday hit German prestige hard throughout Europe. But until Anglo-American troops began to land in force in the West, it was toward the Russians that the Germans looked with fear and the people of the occupied countries with hope. Our landings have started to change all that, and the better and faster our campaign in the West develops, the more rapidly British and American prestige will grow in Western Europe. These landings differ from the invasion of Italy in at least two important respects. First, they show that Britain and the United States have developed first-rate military power on land as well as in the sea and on the air. We are now able to come to grips with the Germans in their own element, land fighting, and have already mastered our two elements, the air and the sea.
That was Columbia's analyst, Quincy Howe. Ladies and gentlemen, the following is the invasion prayer which President Roosevelt wrote while Allied troops were landing on the coast of France, and which he will read to the nation by radio at 10 p.m. Eastern Wartime tonight. My fellow Americans, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness to their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. The enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again, and we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. They will be sore tired by night and by day, without rest till the victory is won. The darkness will be rent by noise and flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violences of war. These are men lately drawn from the ways of peace. They fight not for the lust of conquest. They fight to end conquest. They fight to liberate. They fight to let justice arise and tolerance and goodwill among all thy people. They yearn but for the end of battle, for their return to the haven of home. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom. And for us at home, fathers, mothers, children, wives, sisters and brothers of brave men overseas, whose thoughts and prayers are ever with them, help us, Almighty God, to rededicate ourselves in renewed faith in thee in this hour of great sacrifice. Many people have urged that I call the nation into a single day of special prayer. But because the road is long and the desire is great, I ask that our people devote themselves in continuance of prayer. As we rise to each new day, and again when each day is spent, let words of prayer be on our lips, invoking thy help to our efforts. Give us strength, too, strength in our daily tasks to redouble the contributions we make in the physical and material support of our armed forces. And let our hearts be stout to wait out the long travel, to bear sorrows that may come, to impart our courage unto our sons, wheresoever they may be. And, O Lord, give us faith in thee, faith in our sons, faith in each other, faith in our united crusade. Let not the keenness of our spirit ever be dulled. Let not the impacts of temporary events, of temporal matters, of but fleeting moment, let not these deter us in our unconquerable purpose. With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemy. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country and with our sister nations into a world unity that will spell a sure peace, a peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God. Amen. That is the invasion prayer which President Roosevelt wrote while Allied troops were landing on the coast of France and will be read tonight. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Our convoys did not come under serious attack. The minesweeping was good. It was a low-tide landing, and the minesweepers did the most difficult job ever done by the little ship. They established the clear water, and they led the big ships in. There was no changing of course. They had to contend with a two-knot change in the tide right in the middle of the operation. That meant they were sweeping in a strong cross tide. The weather has not been kind during the first phase of the operation. It was bad when the attack began, but the weathermen said it would improve, and they were right. Many of the men must have had an uncomfortable passage. The air cover had to go in low. But tonight it seems that the weathermen were right. The opinion here seems to be that we are over the first two or three hurdles, but there are many more to come. The American naval forces were able to silence the shore batteries at the points of landing, and our losses at sea have been very, very small. In the air, it is clear that the Luftwaffe has not given serious battle.
Up to noon today, only about 50 enemy fighters had been seen.
It is clear that the Germans haven't yet committed their air force, haven't yet made up their minds. It appears that the Allied air has done its job. Between midnight last night and the early hours of this morning, more than 31,000 airmen were over the target area, and that doesn't count the airborne troops. More than 1,000 heavy bombers were out last night. Then, more than 1,000 of our heavies went out at first light. After them went the mediums and the dive bombers. The lack of enemy response in the air is pleasing, but it is no cause for undue optimism.
They still have a formidable fighter force.
Their morale is still good. They just haven't made up their minds. They're waiting. Göring has issued an order of the day, telling the Luftwaffe it must beat off this attack at all costs, even if the Luftwaffe is destroyed. But he has not yet thrown in his main force. The RAF 2nd Tactical Air Force alone flew more than 2,000 sorties today, providing a fighter umbrella over the invasion beaches. Not a single enemy aircraft had been seen in the bridgehead area up to early afternoon. Returning pilots, who could see the ground operations, described the landing of troops and equipment as going like clockwork. One Spitfire pilot said, "I went through Dunkirk, and I am not ashamed to say that I cried with joy at the sights I saw today." One French flyer remarked, "We all felt as if we were on our way home at last, and it felt good." Prime Minister Churchill has just given the House of Commons a rather full report on the fighting so far. Here's what he reported. The landing of troops on the broad front has been effective, and troops have penetrated several miles inland.
Lodgements exist
on a broad front. Losses are far less than we apprehended. Many dangers and difficulties which appeared at this time last night as extremely formidable are behind us. This operation is proceeding in a thoroughly satisfactory manner. Airborne troops are well established, and the follow-up is proceeding with very much less loss than we expected. Mr. Churchill named a locale of fighting for the first time. He said, "There is even fighting proceeding in the town of Caen." And he indicated that the fighting was not heavy because, in referring to the situation at Caen, he said, "The enemy now will probably try to concentrate in this area. In that event, heavy fighting will soon begin and will continue." Mr. Churchill said, "There is fighting proceeding at various points. We have captured various bridges, which are of importance, and which were not blown up." Mr. Churchill began his second report of the day to the Commons by saying he had been at centers where the latest information is received. After speaking of unexpectedly low losses, he said, "The resistance of the batteries has been greatly weakened by the bombing of the air forces, and the superior bombardment of our ships quickly reduced their power to dimensions which did not affect the problem." He called the landing of airborne troops a marvelous feat and said they were larger than anything there has been so far in the world. He said risks had to be taken in respect of the weather, but he declared that General Eisenhower's courage is equal to all the necessary decisions. He ended by saying, "It is a most serious time that we are entering upon, and we enter upon it with our great allies, all in good heart and in good friendship." And the Commons cheered the Prime Minister's optimistic report. And now, with the immediate worry off our minds about just the getting of a foothold in Europe, it's not too soon to turn some attention to the political problems that liberation, particularly of France, is going to involve. One aspect of the political struggle for power in France was illuminated sharply this afternoon. Early in the afternoon, Marshal Pétain issued a proclamation to the French people, urging them to do just exactly what the Germans want, namely, stay put and carry on with their normal job. Pétain's excuse is that any other course means reprisals and bloodshed. And just a few minutes ago, General de Gaulle, who is now in England, issued an appeal to France of an entirely different kind, an appeal to all Frenchmen to fight the Germans. Fight them wherever and whenever they can strike, and with every possible means. General de Gaulle said that the battle for France was in full swing and that Frenchmen must participate in defeating the already retreating enemy. He told them to sabotage and destroy the German defenses, evade German conscription, and mobilize their assistance to the Allied armies. He called upon Frenchmen to obey the orders of the French government, by which he meant the Committee of National Liberation in Algiers.
and also to obey the orders of the properly delegated French officers. All the hypothetical situations, assumptions, and conflicts about France of the past few years will now soon be proven or disproven in the light of hard results inside France itself. Another report out of Germany casts some light on what may be our strategy in this new attack. This report says that the landings are designed to secure the port of Cherbourg for the landing of heavy equipment, and goes on to say that Allied parachute troops have been dropped at both sides of the base of the peninsula to pinch it off. If this succeeds, the peninsula will fall to us by strangulation, with no way for German reinforcements to rush to the defense of that vital harbor. Whether or not this is so, Richard Hottolet noticed this morning when he was flying over that area that the coast of Normandy is a dead place, with not a truck or motorcycle moving over this road. Meanwhile, there have been more reports, which we cannot yet confirm, to the effect that we have landed on the Channel Islands of Jersey and Guernsey. There will be a communique out later on this evening, and we will see how much of this the Supreme High Command confirms. We return you now to Columbia in New York.
You have just heard Edward R. Murrow, Columbia's Chief of European News. Here in CBS World News headquarters in New York is Doug Edwards.
CBS now continues its reporting of the news of the Allied invasion of Europe. You may be interested to know that since 3:32 this morning, Eastern Wartime, and in the more than 9 hours since then, we've devoted approximately 7 hours to invasion news and analysis. This has included the words of fighting men themselves, reports from eyewitness radio reporters, bulletins from the press associations, communiques from Supreme Allied Headquarters, and urgent messages of government leaders speaking to their people and to all the world. Those of you who've been listening are aware of the urgent pattern we're following, which is to recapture the time of any regular program on our schedule whenever fresh news comes in from the scene of action on this great day of liberation. We have necessarily repeated much of the news in summary form, but have brought you familiar programs in their regular places whenever even repetition has run its course. Fresh news will, of course, be broadcast at any moment within seconds of its receipt and without warning. Stay tuned to your CBS station for constant coverage of the latest news from every theater of the war. Prime Minister Churchill said in London tonight that Allied troops have penetrated in some cases several miles inland after effective landings on the French coast on a broad front. That's a bulletin, and another one just in from the United Press quotes the German DNB news agency as saying this evening that the invasion front has further widened. And Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring declared in an order of the day to the German air forces today that the invasion of Western Europe must be fought off, even if it means the death of the Luftwaffe. That is another bulletin just received in CBS World News headquarters from an enemy source, Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring. Thousands of Allied bombing planes softened up the defenses of Western Europe for the Anglo-American invasion armies last night and early today, dropping more than 11,200 tons of high explosives down on the Nazi coastal fortifications in 8.5 hours of furious attack. The roar of the bursting bombs and the motors of attacking fighter planes rolled back across the narrow straits of Dover incessantly from midnight until 8 a.m. as some 7,500 Allied planes hammered at the network of enemy gun emplacements studding the Channel coast. By mid-morning, the Allied air fleets had swept the skies clear of Nazi planes, and fighters were racing as far as 75 miles inland without drawing a challenge from the battered Luftwaffe. That brings to mind that bulletin which came in a moment ago from Hermann Göring, who declared in an order of the day to the German air forces that the invasion of Western Europe must be fought off, even if it means the death of his vaunted Luftwaffe. Allied invasion forces so far have met less resistance than expected, both in the approaches of the beachheads and in the air. That is from the United Press. Although detailed reports of the situation are lacking still, it's summed up by one observer with the words, "We have gotten over the first 5 or 6 hurdles." And in a broadcast to his homeland, General Charles de Gaulle today called on French patriots to extend all possible aid to the Allied armies and, above all, to do everything not to be taken prisoner by the Germans. His talk, heard over CBS, brought home to the French the fact that their forces never before have had such a glorious opportunity to distinguish themselves. And from London, General Wilhelm Hanstein, the commander-in-chief of the Norwegian underground, broadcast an order to all organized fighting groups inside Norway to be prepared to take part in the Great Settlement, as he put it. Hanstein told his countrymen that they would receive orders on what to do. You must not act openly except in conjunction with the Allied military plan, he said, and not before orders have been issued from London. Prime Minister Churchill conferred with King George at a Buckingham Palace luncheon today, and then both visited General Dwight Eisenhower at his headquarters. The King and Churchill also met with other Allied invasion commanders, and they received late reports coming in from the beachheads in northern France. President Roosevelt spent the early tense morning hours of the invasion writing a prayer which he will read to the nation over all radio networks tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern wartime. CBS, of course, will carry his broadcast. After his fireside chat last night, the president went to his bedroom on the second floor of the White House. Between telephone calls from the War Department telling of the progress of the action, the president wrote a prayer which he wants the country to join in tonight. The prayer has been released for publication, and so that the country might know it and will be able to join with Mr. Roosevelt tonight in praying for victory and for safety for the American forces in this greatest of all military undertakings. Now, another summary of the invasion news to this point. Allied forces landed in the Normandy area of northwest France this morning and have thrust several miles inland against unexpectedly slight German opposition and with losses much smaller than had been anticipated. The grand assault, scheduled for yesterday but postponed until today because of bad weather, found the highly vaunted German defenses much less formidable in every department than had been feared. Airborne troops who led the assault before daylight on a history-making scale suffered extremely small losses in the air, that's what headquarters tells us, even though the great plane fleets extended across 200 miles of sky and used navigation lights to keep formation. Naval losses for the seaborne forces are described at headquarters as very, very small, although 4,000 ships and several thousand smaller craft participated in taking the American, Canadian, and British troops to France. Coastal batteries were virtually silenced by the guns of the British, American, and Allied fleets, including battleships, and the beachheads were speedily consolidated. The German radio said the scene of the landings was a 100-mile stretch of coast from Cherbourg to Le Havre, around the Bay of the Seine and the northeast shore of the Normandy Peninsula. Prime Minister Churchill, in announcing the successful invasion to the House of Commons at noon, 6 hours after the first seaborne troops landed, said the landings were the first of a series. Churchill disclosed that 11,000 Allied planes were available as needed for the battle, the Allied bombers climaxing 96 hours of steady pounding, lashed German coastal defenses this morning with 10,000 tons of explosives. Fighters who went out to guard the beaches had little to do, however, as the German air forces up until noon had flown only 50 sorties against the invading forces. And as we told you a moment ago, the Prime Minister issued another communique from his headquarters this afternoon to say that things were indeed going at least as well and in some cases better than expected. The Germans were known to have probably 1,750 fighters and 500 bombers to meet the attack today, but they did not use them in the start, and why they didn't was not apparent. But Allied airmen warned that a violent reaction may be expected soon, noting that Hermann Göring, in that order of the day, has told his air forces the invasion must be beaten off, even if the Luftwaffe perishes. And the Nazi-operated Paris radio, quoting a last-minute flash from the battlefield, this is a German report, said tonight that a vicious battle is raging north of Rouen between powerful Allied paratroop formations and German anti-invasion forces. These paratroops had landed behind the Atlantic Wall defenses. The Nazi-operated Paris radio, quoting a last-minute flash from the battlefield, as the Germans put it, say that a vicious battle is raging north of Rouen between powerful Allied paratroop formations and German anti-invasion forces. 600 naval guns opening fire on the French coastal stretch west of Le Havre laid down a mighty barrage of 2,000 tons of shells each 10 minutes, beginning at 5:15 a.m. today, British time, as the Allied invasion of Europe began. Apparently taken by surprise, the Germans replied from under a smoke screen laid down by our aircraft to hide us. The red glare of flames enveloped targets. This comes from Pierre Huss, who was representing the combined American press. Covered by the tornadic bombardment, British assault troops successfully stormed ashore at 7:30 a.m. and were clearing the beaches by 7:45. Beginning at 7 a.m., one of the most sustained bombardments struck. It must have stunned the Germans and apparently silenced the majority of the shore batteries. The Luftwaffe was absent. The Allied Air Forces appear to have complete sky mastery. During the night, minesweepers cleared wide passages for the fleet, and then destroyers daringly escorted landing craft to shore while overhead airborne paratroops passed intermittently. And now here in our New York studio, to give you an analysis of the situation as it appears to him at the moment, is Columbia's analyst, Quincy Howe.
The news of these Allied landings on the north coast of France has given the war its most drastic and sudden change since the Germans invaded Russia. Up to less than 12 hours ago, the Russians and the Russians alone had engaged and defeated millions of German troops in vast land battles. Our North African and Italian campaigns had diverted some German strength from Russia. So had our preparation for invasion from the West. The fall of Mussolini in July and the fall of Rome day before yesterday hit German prestige hard throughout Europe. But until Anglo-American troops began to land in force in the West, it was toward the Russians that the Germans looked with fear, and it was toward the Russians that the people of the occupied countries looked with hope. Our landings have started to change all that. And the better and faster our campaign in the West develops, the more rapidly British and American prestige will grow in Western Europe. These landings differ from the invasion of Italy in at least two important respects. First, they show that Britain and the United States have developed first-rate military power on land, as well as in the air and on the sea. We're now able to come to grips with the Germans in their own element, that's land fighting, having already mastered our two elements, the air and the sea. The campaign in Italy amounted to little more than a dress rehearsal compared with the scale of the present attack. Then, in the second place, these landings in France represent our first attempt at real liberation as compared with invasion. Although the Italian people had little liking for Mussolini and nothing but hatred for the Germans, the French people went into the war against the Germans and have lived under German domination for the past 4 years. Just as the landings in Europe will demonstrate the military power and skill of Britain and America, so these same landings will demonstrate the popular following and the fighting power that the underground resistance movement has developed in France and perhaps in other countries of Western Europe, too. For these other countries have also received notification that the liberation has begun. At the moment, though, General de Gaulle has become the key figure in the whole European resistance movement. That's because the first landings have occurred in France, and because General de Gaulle has no rival as a leader of French resistance. But it may be some time before we know how strong the French resistance movement proves, and how much General de Gaulle himself can deliver. Raymond Daniel cabled a dispatch from London to the New York Times this morning, a few hours before the landing began. This dispatch warned the American people not to expect too much of the French resistance movement. It pointed out the great difficulties under which the French must operate. The American decision to withhold full diplomatic recognition from General de Gaulle and the French committee is therefore being put to its first practical test. And if the resistance movement does not live up to the hopes that some of us have placed in it, there may be a temptation to blame that on General de Gaulle rather than on the French situation as a whole. If, however, the French resistance movement does prove effective, then General de Gaulle and his French committee will have scored a double triumph. They will have prevailed not only against the opposition of the Germans, but against the doubts and hesitations of President Roosevelt and our State Department. The people of the other occupied countries with their exile leaders will also follow events in France with passionate life and death interest. They'll see first how strong we are. Then they'll see how much authority an exiled leader carries. And if General de Gaulle cannot rally the French people around him with all his contacts in the French underground, then the exile leaders of Belgium and Holland, and perhaps of Norway, too, may have reason to believe that from now on, the leaders of the resistance struggle will be found inside Europe and nowhere else. The Russians will also watch the course of the invasion with just as much interest as we're watching it over here, perhaps even with more interest, and this is why. Ever since the Germans invaded their country, nearly 3 years ago, the Russians have been clamoring for a second front in the West. During these 3 years, they've had about one-third of their richest territories invaded and laid waste. Nearly one-third of the Russian people have been enslaved at one time or another by the Germans. For 3 years, the Russians have been living for this day of liberation because they've always believed that only large-scale military operations in the West can take enough German divisions off their necks for them to be able to hit back with decisive strength and really smash the German war machine. This Russian demand for a second front in the West is impossible to reconcile with the fears that some people have that Russia hopes and plans to dominate the whole European continent. Quite the opposite. Only by large-scale military operations in the West can the Anglo-American powers hope to exercise political influence over Western Europe. And the Russians are realistic enough to understand this. They'll gladly exchange a little loss of their influence, whatever it may be, in Western Europe, for military assistance from us in their task of beating the main body of the German army, which, remember, is still drawn up on the Eastern Front. If today is a bright day for the Russians, it's a dark day for the Germans. The last German hope of making a separate peace with the Russians on the one hand or the Anglo-Americans on the other has now gone up the spout. Both the Russians and the Anglo-American powers are now far too deeply committed to their present strategy. They have too much to win by keeping it up, too much to lose by abandoning it. Nevertheless, we can expect to hear plenty of German propaganda that will continue to try to stir up suspicion and division between the Anglo-Americans and the Russians. The Germans are now under pressure from east, south, and west. They have a three-front war on their hands, and they'll fight this war with political as well as military weapons in the hope that somehow, somewhere, one of these offensives can be called off. And the Japanese are going to watch with deep concern what's happening in Europe right now. If the Anglo-Soviet-American coalition comes through its present test in Europe, then the Japanese will have good reason to fear trouble for themselves later in Asia. But any split between the Anglo-Americans and the Russians would redound only to the benefit of Japan. That's why the combined liberation of Europe means bad news for Tokyo. Finally, there's the American aspect of today's great happenings. The United States now stands at the peak of its military, of its economic, of its political, and of its moral power in the world. Never in the history of our country has our power of every sort, counted for so much as it does today. More than 150 years of American history lie behind the unexampled effort that this country is now making all over the world, not only in Western Europe, but in Italy, in the South Pacific, in Asia, on the seaways and skyways of the world, and right here at home, in our factories and on our farms. We're throwing everything we've got this summer into the greatest military operation of all time. But it's much more than a military operation. The fate of the whole world is involved. And in that fate, the United States has the decisive role to play.
You have just heard Quincy Howe, Columbia's news analyst. Keep tuned to your Columbia station for a return to CBS World News Headquarters in just 30 seconds. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System. Now, here in New York, is Columbia's correspondent, John Daly.
The latest news we have of the Allied invasion of northwestern France is still in that bulletin from the Associated Press in London, which reports that Prime Minister Churchill said tonight that Allied troops had penetrated in some cases several miles inland after effective landings on the French coast on a broad front. In Washington, President Roosevelt's top military, naval, and air chieftains reported to him that the massive Allied cross-channel assault is going well up to now. The invasion is doing all right so far, Admiral Ernest J. King, the commander-in-chief of our Navy, said as he left the White House after an hour-and-a-half conference with the chief executive. Into our studios and our newsroom here in New York have come a series of eyewitness dispatches from the other side of the world where the fighting is going on. We'll read some of these dispatches to you to give you a clear picture of what is happening as the Allied troops storm the fortress of Hitler. Correspondent E.V. Roberts, representing the combined American press, has sent, for instance, a dispatch telling how General Eisenhower spent the hours just before our men went ashore in France. General Eisenhower, he said, stood on a rooftop on Invasion Eve and watched a mighty airborne armada form in the sky and wing its way toward France and the beginning of the final phase of the War of Liberation. The Supreme Commander radiated a calm confidence contagious to those about him. He spent the greater part of the day among the troops, seaborne and airborne, walking from group to group, chatting and laughing with the men. At 2:30 p.m., says Roberts, on Monday, Eisenhower met with a small group of British and American press and radio representatives. He told them that the invasion of Europe would be launched Tuesday and the machinery was already in motion. They were informed that the operation would be the largest of its type ever launched and that the Allies had assembled their mightiest land, sea, and air force for the purpose. Eisenhower talked to them for an hour and a half. The conference took place in his command tent, a plain, bare-walled structure about 20 feet square with canvas roof and walls of stained pine boards. At the start, he greeted each correspondent with a handshake and a friendly, lopsided grin. He stressed the importance of the job his staff officers, British and American, had done in preparing and launching the blow, and spoke earnestly of his desire to emphasize this. The weather, the correspondents learned, had been the biggest Allied headache in the selection of D-Day. At one time, General Eisenhower interrupted his discourse to look out of the door and comment with enthusiasm upon a patch of sunshine. The general sat comfortably slouched behind his big, battered desk. On the desktop was a green telephone, a desk lamp, an inkwell, and a packet of cigarettes. During the conference, he occasionally leaned forward to tap with a finger for emphasis. He smoked constantly, sometimes lighting one cigarette from another. Beyond that, he made no movement. He did not appear to notice the express train roar of constant Allied air patrols overhead. Roberts adds that after the conference, the general stood outside, hatless and with hands in pockets, and chatted with the reporters informally. They remarked upon his calmness, and one asked him, "Don't these things make you nervous?" He chuckled and said he was the type that boiled up inside, but that when things got too bad, he was usually able to sleep it off. He told them that he planned to visit the airborne units during the evening, and that before turning in, he would probably read a little philosophy or a Wild West story. The correspondents were then permitted to tag along on the Supreme Commander's visit to the airborne units, but only with the understanding that they would remain definitely in the background. There is a warm, personal relationship between General Eisenhower and his men, and he made it clear that he wished it to remain personal. Roberts says that as the party swept along a road overlooking a coastal town en route to the airborne bases, the correspondents could see a great flotilla of landing craft out at sea. At the airborne assembly areas, Eisenhower walked swiftly and alone through the groups of men where they were drawn up at attention. He asked that they be placed at ease. He stopped frequently, picking men at random to talk with. Often he was completely surrounded by the men, and they trooped after him, laughing and joking like schoolboys. The reporters estimate that during the evening hours, he talked with several hundred men individually. He asked them where they were from. He seemed determined to find a paratrooper from his home state of Kansas, and what they did in civilian life, and what their army job was. And then he added personal touches. He asked a youngster where he got his hair cut, and an ex-Dakota farmer how much wheat he grew per acre. He asked about the weird war paint of the paratroopers, and was told that it was a mixture of cocoa and cottonseed oil. "It tastes good," one trooper told him. The Supreme Commander's party reached the last base just at takeoff, says Roberts. At 7-second intervals, the big C-47s roared off the runway and lurched into the sky in a seeming endless stream. Eisenhower was escorted to the roof of headquarters for a better view as they circled above, coming into formation for the great task ahead. He turned his face toward France and watched them vanish in the darkening sky. And that's how General Eisenhower spent the last hours before invasion.